From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak, and this morning we speak with renowned physicist and futurist Michio Kaku. He joins the show to discuss string theory, quantum computing, and how the next wave of scientific breakthroughs could transform life and technology. Then, in the second half, writer and business strategist Lee Malcher, who explores the surprising parallels between human relationships and quantum entanglement, uncovering how science and spirituality intersect in our search for authentic connection. A little string theory, a little spirituality here on Cool Science Radio this morning. Why not? It's all connected somehow. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Scott Greenberg.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
Today, we are thrilled to be joined by world-renowned physicist, futurist, and best-selling author, Dr. Michio Kaku.
Dr. Kaku has a gift for making the most complex ideas in science both clear and exciting. And he's done just that in his books, Quantum Supremacy, which explores the dawn of quantum computing, and The God Equation, where he examines string theory as the long-sought theory of everything.
Dr. Kaku has spent his career translating cutting-edge physics into ideas that spark our imagination about the future. From parallel universes and time travel to artificial intelligence and the fate of humanity, his work challenges us to think bigger about where science is taking us. Dr. Kaku, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Glad to be on.
So we're going to get into a lot of stuff today. We're going to talk about string theory and all sorts of future ideas, but I want to start way back. Your earliest influence, as I understand it, was Albert Einstein and his unfinished book, The Theory of Everything. And I think the goal was to read the mind of God. Take us back to that very early influence for you.
Well, for me, it started when I was 8 years old. All the newspapers said that a great scientist had just died, but they said they put a picture of his desk on the evening news with the caption that this great scientist could not finish this book. Well, I was fascinated. What could be so hard that a great scientist could not finish this book? Why didn't he ask his mother? Why didn't he simply go to the library and look up the answer? Well, I finally went to the library myself and found out this man had a name, Albert Einstein. And that book was to be the theory of everything, an equation perhaps no more than 1 inch long that would, quote, read the mind of God. Well, I was hooked. I had to know everything about this man, Albert Einstein, and what he was looking for, and a 1-inch equation that would allow him to solve the secrets of the universe. So when I was in high school, I wanted to be part of this great revolution. So I said to my mom, "Mom, can I have permission to build an atom smasher in the garage? A 2.3 million electron volt betatron power accelerator in the garage?" And my mom said, "Sure, why not? And don't forget to take out the garbage." Well, I took out the garbage and I assembled a 2.3 million electron volt betatron particle accelerator in the garage. Finally, after winding 22 miles of copper wire, assembling 6 kilowatts of power, it was finally finished. Well, I turned it on, I closed my ears, and I heard this pop, pop, pop sound as I blew out all the circuit breakers in the house, and the whole house was plunged in darkness. My poor mom, she must have said to herself, "Why couldn't I have a son who plays baseball? Why not basketball? Why does he build these things in the garage?" Well, yes, I went to the National Science Fair, where I met Edward Teller, father of the hydrogen bomb. And I didn't have to explain to him what I was doing. He knew exactly what I was doing. And he offered me a scholarship to Harvard. And that began my career as a physicist. So sometimes Building a small atom smasher in your garage can lead to all sorts of doors opening up.
Well, I have three boys, and I have to say, none of them ever come to me and ask me permission to build an atom smasher in our garage. And I have to be honest, I think I would have said no. You are considered the founder of string field theory, very important physics area. How did this start? What were you doing when you decided, yeah, I think string theory could have a future here?
Well, it all happened when I was in the United States Army. The war in Vietnam was hitting a peak. All deferments at Harvard were thrown out the window. It was your duty to fight and perhaps die for the United States military. So I was in the Army, and there was plenty of time to think, because, of course, after you do machine guns and throw grenades, there's nothing to do except wait for the trucks to take you back to headquarters. So during that time, I was able to play with string theory. String theory was a theory that was just a collection of rules of thumb, things that people didn't know what the hell we were doing working with something called string theory. But I found an equation that summarized all the power of string theory. It's called string field theory. And so I did it when I was in the United States military, where I had plenty of time to think about the universe.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Michio Kaku. He is known to be one of the co-founders of string field theory, different from string theory. And we're going to ask him just why that is in a second here. And he has said that he wants to complete Einstein's dream. So first of all, Dr. Kuk, how does string theory differ from string field theory? I think most of our listeners and many people, unless you are theoretical physicists, don't really understand string theory. So we always love to review it every couple of years and how it differs from string field theory.
Well, string theory, we think, is the theory of everything. That is an equation, perhaps a few inches long, that would allow us to, quote, read the mind of God. And that was Einstein's dream. These are his words. However, string theory has to be put into an equation which allows you to solve for these things. And that's string field theory. So string field theory is string theory. It's the same thing, except it's crystallized into what equation?
Okay. Now, as you know, going back to when you were that young boy and you read that this very famous scientist couldn't complete his book and you wondered why, Einstein did an incredible amount in his life, and it was his own desire, his own search for a unified theory of everything that he didn't get to. He did a lot. I mean, the theory of, you know, relativity and space-time and the many things that he did do. How have you in your lifetime and over 40 years of as a professor teaching this and turning people onto it, how have you contributed to that? And what are your hopes for finishing your book and Einstein's book?
Well, let me now summarize the last 2,000 years of investigation into the nature of matter and energy. We have two theories that have emerged over 2,000 years of mistrials and dead ends, two theories which we think explain the universe as we know it. The first is Einstein's theory of relativity, a theory of gravity, a theory that gives us space-time that's curved, and it's been experimentally verified by looking at the stars in the universe. So that's relativity, a theory of space-time. Then we have quantum theory, a theory of the atom, a theory that allows you to explain neutrons and protons. And the two theories look totally different. Einstein's theory of gravity is based on smooth surfaces. Think of a surface that is smooth, but it bends and it changes shape. That's Einstein's theory of general relativity. But quantum theory deals with particles. How many particles? Hundreds. thousands of particles. So many particles that he'd go crazy trying to learn all the Greek letters of the alphabet, trying to give names to all these particles. But these two theories summarize the universe as we know it. Everything we know about the physical universe can be summarized by these two theories. The theory of the very big, that is Einstein's theory of relativity, and the theory of the small, which is quantum mechanics, which gives us neutrons and protons and subatomic particles, radiation, and the energy output of stars. We want to put these two things together. And if one of your listeners ever finds the way to do it, to combine relativity with quantum mechanics, they will receive the Nobel Prize in Physics.
Dr. Kaku, you are known for taking the complicated and boiling down and making it understandable. And our motto here at Cool Science Radio is, if we can understand it, so can you. So if you would be so kind as to indulge me and take a minute and explain, what is string theory?
Well, why do we have so many subatomic particles? We have electrons, we have neutrons, we have protons. We are drowning in subatomic particles without any larger rhyme or reason, put together by some malicious ghost in the universe. However, string theory says, no, all these subatomic particles with strange names, they're nothing but music. It's the music of vibrating strings. So when a string vibrates in this way, we call it a neutron. When it vibrates in this way, it's called a proton. And how many ways can a string vibrate? An infinite number of ways you can vibrate a string. And that's why we have so many subatomic particles. It's just basically one string that vibrates in different modes, and each mode corresponds to a Greek letter of the alphabet. And that's why subatomic particle physics seems so crazy. And so we think that the basic constituent of the universe is music, the music of small subatomic particles that are vibrating. So what is chemistry? Chemistry is the melodies you can combine with putting these things together. And then what is the universe? The universe is a symphony of vibrating strings. And then what is the mind of God? We think that it's cosmic music, the music of subatomic strings vibrating, that is the mind of God.
All right, well, that's going to be really hard to get my head around, but the music, the symphony of the universe is really a very complex thing to kind of consider. And now we're going to take a little bit of a shift, because I know that when we were just talking about quantum mechanics, I think for us to figure out the computing power of what you're talking about is going to take a whole new revolution in computational analysis. So I want to talk a little bit about what is a quantum computer and how it differs from what we consider today, I guess, a digital computer?
Yes, I work in string theory, where we think that all the subatomic particles of nature are nothing but musical notes. Right now, we're investigating the lowest octave of the string. We call that the Standard Model. In fact, many Nobel Prizes, about 20 Nobel Prizes have been given to various physicists who put together pieces of the Standard Model. And we think that's just the lowest octave of a vibrating string. But the string has higher octaves. In fact, the number of octaves could go on forever. And that's why we need a quantum computer to keep track of all these subatomic particles. We are literally drowning in subatomic particles. And we've sent billions of dollars building atom smashers in Geneva and different places around the world to test our theories about these subatomic particles. And so we think that the ultimate goal of subatomic particles is to find the music, the harmonies, the melodies that make the universe work. And I got into it because I thought maybe quantum computers is the way to do it. You know, computers are very powerful, but they're not powerful enough. Our computers are not powerful enough to make sense of the hundreds of subatomic particles that we find in string theory. That's why I think that one day string theory will be solved using a quantum computer.
Dr. Kaku, how does this onset of AI being so widespread, you know, most people are using it at this point. How does it relate at all to quantum computing, or how does it contribute to the advancement of quantum computing?
Well, what is the essence of computation? The essence of computation is the fact that atoms can be spin up or spin down. Two states, up or down, or on or off. So realize that the world economy, your bank account, your life is based on counting up and down, up and down. That is the basis of the world economy. Digital. Everything is digital. But Mother Nature is not digital. Go outside. Look at the trees, the forests, the birds. Look at Mother Nature. And you begin to realize that Mother Nature is not digital at all. Mother Nature is quantum, because atoms can be spin up, spin down, and anything in between. So how does Mother Nature compute? Mother Nature computes not with up and down. Mother Nature computes with atoms that can be oriented at any angle whatsoever. And that's why I think the next step beyond digital is quantum. Quantum computers are going to be infinitely more powerful than digital computers. In fact, they are so powerful that we have to be careful that criminals don't get access to quantum computing, and they'll be able to crack any known digital code. And so who's interested in this? Everybody. Especially the nations of the world, the Chinese, the United States, the Russians, they're all in the game of building not a digital computer that is based on zeros and ones, but quantum computers that could be in any orientation, up, down, sideways. And I think that there's a race going on between China and the United States. The Chinese government has the most advanced optical computer on Earth. I repeat, the Chinese have already created the most advanced optical computer that computes on light beams. Why? Because light beams travel faster than electrons. I repeat, light beams travel faster than electrons. And so their computer computes faster than our quantum computer. However, we should point out that quantum computers based on light beams have to be disassembled, reconstructed after every calculation. What a pain in the butt. So in America, quantum computers are based on electrons. They're not as fast as light beams, but they're more sophisticated, more agile than working with light beams. So in other words, there's a race. And what's at stake? Everything. Your bank account, the treasury of nations, the stock market, investment portfolios are all based on dollars and cents, are all based on up and down, up and down. So who's worried about this transition from digital to quantum? Everybody.
Everyone. It's sort of like back in the 1960s with the space race between the U.S. and Russia, but the stakes are much higher now, obviously, as you have said. So at this point, then, we don't have reliable quantum computers. Progress is happening quickly. We have seen how quickly it came on, the onset of AI. One question for you. Will quantum computers use less energy because of the quantum element?
We don't know. Some people are thinking that, yes, they'll consume more energy because of the number of states you can calculate with. A calculator, a pocket calculator that you have in your pocket, doesn't use that much energy because it simply adds 1 + 1 = 2 and uses that as the basis for computation. A digital computer is more sophisticated. It uses much more energy. But a quantum computer computes on anything between 0 and 1. And what's between 0 and 1? Everything. Think of all the digits that are between 0 and 1. And then you begin to realize that it's going to take a lot of power to keep this going. But as I said before, the nations of the world are all keyed on trying to figure this out, because the prize is to create the architecture for the next century. We're talking about digital computers being replaced by quantum computers in your pocket, in your bank account, in the wealth of nations. This is going to be the rule of thumb.
Dr. Kaku, you once said that quantum computers will make digital computers look like an abacus.
Oh, that's right.
And we've been talking about the security issues surrounding quantum computation, but there's also a huge upside as well. I mean, this can result in huge breakthroughs in agriculture and medicine.
Yeah, I mean, look outside. You see the leaves, the forest, the trees, you see animals. All of them use quantum computers. So Mother Nature has already solved the problem of room temperature quantum computers. And what is it called? It's called life. Life itself is a function of room temperature quantum computers. Now, our computers are so primitive, they have to work at near absolute zero, which is very expensive, very time consuming. But that's the way we do it in our laboratories, is we freeze liquids down to near absolute zero and use that as the platform on which to do quantum calculations. But you're right. Think of all the things that Mother Nature can do. Mother Nature can create food, create crops. We can't do that with our primitive computers, but that's what Mother Nature does. And so if we solve the secret of quantum computers, we can also solve the problem of energy, life, and be able to revolutionize medicine and create new forms of energy. So this could be the next big thing. Rather than computing on zeros and ones, computing on everything between zeros and one to create an architecture for the next century.
So let's circle back to the beginning of this conversation where we were talking about string theory. And is it possible that we're going to be able to use quantum computers to solve string theory and finally have Albert Einstein's dream realized, where we could read the mind of God?
Well, that's the hope. You see, we have the theory. We have the theory. I helped to write parts of the theory. We have the theory. The problem is no one is smart enough to solve the theory. Now, we had a similar situation with the proton, as I mentioned. We have a theory of the proton. It's called quantum chromodynamics, and it works. You put the equations inside a computer, and the computer will then begin to calculate the properties of subatomic particles like neutrons and protons. It's a big success. Nobel Prizes have been awarded for people that have worked in this. But when we talk about the universe, we have the equations of string theory. I helped to write some of these equations myself. The problem is solving it with a computer. Right now, no computer is powerful enough to solve lattice gauge theory for all the subatomic particles of the universe. That's where I hope that perhaps string theory could come to the rescue. Just the way computers came to the rescue by solving the properties of a proton, perhaps computers, quantum computers, will allow us to solve the equations of string theory.
That's the hope.
Okay, well, we've been speaking with Dr. Michio Kaku, sharing insights from his books, Quantum Supremacy and the God Equation, and helping us imagine what the next frontier of science and technology might look like. His ability to connect physics with our everyday lives is a reminder of just how close the future really is. Dr. Michio Kaku, thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. Our next guest describes himself as, quote, an ordinary dude who walks in two worlds, a business strategist by day, and by night, a writer whose debut book, The Leeway, Navigating the Modern Hero's Journey, launches in the coming weeks.
Lee Malcher sits at the intersection of science, spirituality, and human connection. Drawing on his own experiences, he's developed a unique perspective on transformation and authenticity, including a look at love itself through the lens of quantum entanglement.
We're excited to explore the science behind the metaphor, the nature of change, and what it really means to be authentic in a world that doesn't always reward it. Lee, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, I know we're kind of trying to focus a little bit on the sciencey part of quantum entanglement. Lee, you describe yourself as someone walking in two worlds. How did your business background and your personal journey come together in your new book, Leeway?
Good question. It's really the battle of ego. Working in business, there's a lot of ego-driven behavior that can cause problems and challenges in personal life when you forget to remind yourself of who you are. You can really get caught up in that act of business. And that's something that I've lived through personally and worked on to the point where I've really tried to get my ego in check in my personal life as well. And my book is essentially the battle about ego in a nutshell.
Was there a moment or a spark that made you decide to write this book?
You know, it was living through an ordeal or a few ordeals in my early 30s. I really came to the conclusion. I ended up, you know, being introduced to depth psychology and therapy and personal transformation work. And what I really realized is I would have loved to have had a framework for growth in my early 20s, something to help me navigate the challenges that every young man kind of goes through in their early 20s. And I'd done all this kind of work and realized that there's not much access to the specific frameworks that I kind of work on, which is heavily based on like the hero's journey and Carl Jung psychology. And so essentially I just wrote a book that I wanted to give myself as a 22, 23 year old. In hopes that that can help and make a difference, be it big or small.
Mm-hmm. Lee, I'm wondering, since we are a science show, and since part of what you're talking about is this notion of quantum entanglement, it feels like in recent years, decades, maybe even, when people talk about the spiritual and the mystical, they kind of try to attach it to science by using that word quantum. And of course, we're talking, you know, quantum physics, quantum entanglement, which I suppose has a little bit of a root in things that we can't explain. And so that's how it maybe ties into the mystical or the spiritual. But we like to talk science. And I know your wife, of course, is a scientist. And she couldn't join us today because you have a baby, an infant who needs her attention. But explain a little bit about what you've learned coming from the spiritual side and then your wife coming from the science side.
So, you know, again, through all this, I'm certainly no scientist. It was actually the subject I was least good at school. Through just personal work, you develop these kind of just intuitive kind of ideas and thoughts and views, and it can come across as very spiritual. When I first met my wife, I'd just come out of a huge transformation period. And, you know, actually, our first date, the morning of our first date, I'd done like a breathwork session, which is considered spiritual, I guess, in many ways. And I'd never done that before. It's actually one of the only times I'd ever done that. And a 2-hour breathwork session is pretty intense, it turns out. And, you know, an hour later, I was due to be on a date with my wife. And I turned up to this date and, you know, I was very, very deep and philosophical. And I kind of felt like disconnected. And, you know, 20 minutes in, I thought, hey, I'm losing this date here. Like, I'm talking way too deep. I'm way too weird. I'm coming across as some weird spiritual guy. And in my view, I thought I was really losing the date, so to speak. So I threw a little bit of a Hail Mary after 30 minutes. I said, hey, do you want to go and grab something to eat and grab a beer? And so we grabbed a beer, something to eat, and the energy completely shifted. But it developed this nice dynamic where I was a little bit more comfortable and within myself. And I kind of apologized for being a little bit too kind of deep.
Too woo-woo.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we got talking and she asked me one specific question, which, you know, really is something you don't often get on a first date. And it was, what are your views on love? And again, I was still kind of coming into myself, still kind of landing into this, coming from this spiritual kind of way of thinking. And I went on kind of a rant about, hey, like, you know, like, it's like my idea of love is like my two particles that kind of like exist and then they come together and they join and they create a kind of vortex, and that vortex is called love. It was like a 5-minute spiel, honestly. And she kind of just looked at me with deadpan eyes and said, so you're talking about science? And I was like, what do you mean? She's like, well, you're kind of talking about, you know, physics, quantum physics and cells and how they behave. And this was completely new and alien to me. And so that just led into me learning from her. And this really beautiful kind of insight of like, huh, all these kind of intuitive, and even intuitive is a strong word, you know, because it wasn't intuitive in a sense where I felt like it was really real. It was just coming to me. And it was like, for all I knew, it just could have been a random thought of nonsense, but it felt there was something to it. And her scientific lens just anchored it into more real, more authentic. And that was a special moment.
That's a great story. Like it.
Well, okay, so you had just come from this breathwork session. And from what I know about breathwork, it can be very scientific in that what is happening in your body is happening kind of on a cellular level, like something about the breath work induces a change or releases what we store on a cellular level. So that is science, right? And your wife is a molecular and cell biologist, correct? Okay. And so, yeah, continue on with this conversation when you explain what that is to her.
Yeah, so, okay. So I guess we're talking about the, you know, love itself. And, you know, there's a big part. I think I kind of mentioned like the particles kind of having a vibration. Again, forgive me for my lack of scientific language, but, you know, for me, everything has a vibration, right? And two particles existing, they vibrate at a certain frequency. And look, there's other particles that exist that vibrate at different frequencies. And sometimes you come across and you get attracted to this other particle and you start interacting with them. And, you know, that kind of interaction can evolve in many different ways and mean many different things. For me, in the view of love, it's that force of the dance of two particles combining. And, you know, there's this common, I don't want to segue too much, but my idea of love was very different before this particular conversation. And my idea of love was essentially, it was based on my parents' relationship, right? Because we act as whatever we grew up with. And so my programming, fortunately and unfortunately, was through my parents who had been together since they were 13, 14 years old. So I always think of this as like, you know, my growing up, it was a classic 80s romanticism, all the movies, you know, you think of that movie Jerry Maguire with the tagline of, you know, you complete me. That was my idea of love, which was I need to find someone who fills a gap for me and completes me. And so in my relationship history, that was the path that I kind of always tried to follow. And through ordeal and growth, I eventually realized that that wasn't the path. That was a programming. And I slowly started to let go of that kind of conditioning and programming and started to see that as a little bit more of a social construct and the idea of, you know, romantic love. And this is where the, you know, the separate idea of two particles having an independent existence, first and foremost, that can grow independently, but can still have an interaction together and a dance in romantic terms that creates a force that I can recognize romantically as love. And look, love can exist in different ways, right? It can be intimate romantic love. It can be a relationship, a friend or family. But that was that dynamic that really kind of just feels right to me.
Wow. You just described quantum entanglement in a very, very layperson term. I thought that was great. If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking to Lee Melcher, who is a business strategist, author, and now philosopher and part-time physicist, I think. Lee, let me describe to our listeners a little bit how we got here, because this is, I think, a little unorthodox for Cool Science Radio. So I think it's kind of important to give a little bit of background. I have a weekly Zoom chat with two of my dearest friends who are scientists, and we get into these very deep conversations. And I can't remember exactly how we stumbled on quantum entanglement, but we went down a very, very deep rabbit hole. And one of my friends' chat said, well, I wonder if there's such a thing as love and quantum entanglement, if there could be two separate entities that exist in the universe that are independent but are yet bound by this invisible force that we call love. And I was like, you know, well, that's crazy. No, that can't possibly be. And while we were talking, I literally Googled the subject, quantum entanglement and love. And lo and behold, Lee Melcher's article popped into my screen. And I went, guys, stop the press. You're not going to believe this. I found a guy who wrote about quantum entanglement. So we're going to back up a little bit and talk about that first date and how she explains this to you. So an Englishman and a molecular and cell biologist walk into a bar, and there's a spark, there's a connection. And we have talked about quantum entanglement, and we have these two separate entities from across different universes that are now somehow connected. How did you draw the line between those two?
So, you know, something that's coming up actually is my wife explained the double slit experiment. And, you know, essentially, one of the biggest takeaways from the double slit experiment that I took was that behavior of particles change based on the observer, whether they are being observed or not. So when I talk about that that force and two particles existing, going on their independent journeys and still being connected no matter what distance, for me, there's some kind of similarity with observation there, attention, like conscious observation. And that really speaks to that dynamic, you know, that power of love is, look, particles can exist. They can have a relationship no matter how far apart, but it's also heavily kind of reliant on conscious attention still, you know? And that's a big, otherwise you can, you know, we go through the world and we meet other people. And I always do it visually. It's hard to do it over radio, but particles existing and then we're kind of intertwining like this and that force, but then particles can get further away, right? But the core thing for me is attention, like conscious attention to each other that maintains the power of that force, no matter how far. And that was the biggest takeaway that I got. And when my wife started talking about the double slit experiment, and there's another one that I can't quite remember. It's like a quantum physics kind of experiment. Then that was a big takeaway for me.
Lee, going back then to the fact that you felt like growing up, science was your worst subject. I think this is really interesting because I feel like a lot of people shy away from science for that same reason, myself included. And now I'm absolutely addicted to science. And so I want, as a result of hosting this show for now 12 years. So I'm wondering how that has shaped sort of your worldview as well, and how much it has gotten you, to borrow the word, entangled in science, and how you continue to use it to explain all of the rest of the things that you're talking about in your new book.
Yeah, so I'm more on the part of science that really kind of resonates with me is the psychology. And you know, my book is much more about the psychological side of life rather than like science, but it doesn't, you know, again, I bring up Carl Jung. Carl Jung, for me, he was really brave enough to delve into that kind of theory, you know, where science normally stops, he would kind of delve into. And that can be, you know, considered mystical. And some, you know, sometimes it gets, people take advantage of that and can kind of, you know, get a bit too far into the weeds of everything else. But you know, just on that fine line of like, just on the cutting edge of empirical science and, you know, the unknown, that for me is what's interesting, like identifying or having an understanding of possibility just beyond what we already know, and accepting that we don't actually, we may never know anything. And so a lot of my book, to be quite honest, is about navigating the unknown as well. And using it, you know, I came across this term a few months ago when someone was reading my book for the first time, and they kind of said, "Oh, it's in the psycho-spiritual genre," and that was a term that was, you know, unfamiliar to me. But it kind of makes sense as to me. It's like, okay, it's like psychological and spiritual. It's that fine line between science and the unknown.
Mm-hmm. It's funny as you talk. I've been thinking about our medical world, Eastern versus Western medicine, and how in recent, you know, in the past, I don't know, 10, 15 years, you start to see that Eastern and Western must come together. Those who are Western practitioners must embrace Eastern medicine and vice versa, and realize that there are complements between the two. And it makes me wonder about now that you're going through your life with this sort of complement between the spiritual and the scientific, if you see these kinds of parallels just popping up all over the place.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I think, you know, there's, in the last couple of hundred years, we've got a bit, you know, in my view, we've got very caught up in the science side when, you know, we've got thousands and thousands of years of just human kind of behavior and observation. And the challenge is like those Eastern practices and approaches, it just can't be proven. But it's just through, you know, human application and process that they've got the feedback and that kind of, you know, that works. So look, I think a big thing for me, again, this is what my book kind of touches on, not to keep on promoting it, but it's, the world is changing so quickly in science, in technology. I have a bit of a calling is to like maintain that kind of, you know, humanity through ancient practices, traditions, so we can, you know, it's been lost in recent times. And so that applies to science and medicine as well. I think, you know, one of the big surprises for me, Scott, when you talk about how my article was the one that came up when we're talking about love and quantum entanglement, That's highly surprising to me, and that no one's kind of done that. And I kind of have this idea of like, well, it's almost like quantum entanglement, quantum physics has stayed in the science classroom, and this idea of love has stayed in the literature and, you know, in a literature kind of classroom. And those two classrooms have never really kind of combined. And so that for me is, you know, I guess I would like more of a convergence of all these worlds.
You certainly seem to have this intersection of science, spirituality, and humanity intersecting, which I'm very excited about reading your book when it comes out. And I think that it's going to be really cool also for our listeners. I want to make sure that we do put a plug in for your book at the end here. But I'm curious, do you think your future work, after having now written this book about this intersection of science and spirituality and humanity all kind of coming together, almost, you know, to use a sciencey term, colliding, do you think that's going to inform your future work or your future life?
Absolutely. There's one thing that I've learned is that growth is inevitable. Understanding, you know, how to align with growth and apply that to both worlds that, you know, we almost certainly have to walk in two worlds, which is, you know, is business or career and also personal. For me, it's definitely, I want to help others grow. But the cool thing is I can also help people navigate growing in both worlds. That's kind of my personal goal, is to do that.
So Lee, we've talked a lot about you and how you've learned about science. And I'm kind of curious about how your cellular and molecular biologist wife, how it has informed her work and how it has maybe transformed her a little bit to look
Great.
Towards this unexplained, you know, possibly spiritual world.
Yeah, that's a really good question. I'm glad you asked that, Lynn. So when I first met my wife, she used to say things like, hey, you know, I'm not really good with words, like writing birthday cards or love notes. She'd always say like, no, I'm not really good at that. And she used to kind of feel a little bit like in my shadow because maybe I speak more or spoke more from the heart. Now it's the complete other way around. You know, I've just been on a week-long retreat in the mountains in West Virginia, and she gave me a little note because I was disconnected from society. You get your phone taken from you. But I had this little note that I read every night, and just the way she articulated from the heart, every single line was just beautiful. And that just shows, I think, the beauty of our relationship, the dynamic that we've created, and the balance and harmony. And it feels saying out loud feels very special, and I feel very grateful for it that we've been able to impact each other in that way.
Yeah, that also kind of dovetails with what we try to do here on Cool Science Radio, which is, and what I think science communicators around the world are learning now is that, you know, we need to talk about science in terms that are real to people, you know.
Absolutely. I asked that, Lynn.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about Leeway. When is it coming out? When can we expect to see it?
Yeah, thank you. So look, it's been 5 years in the making. It's been something I've been working on weekends. So it's long overdue, but essentially it's the book that I wanted to give myself as a 22, 23 year old. It's a framework for growth, but it's got a lot of personal anecdotes from my own journey that, you know, I've applied some British wit. And some, you know, it ranges from British wit to deeply kind of spiritual and a little bit kind of out there. I explore interesting topics such as psychology, such as science, but also like UFOs, aliens, and gut, you know, and looking at those kind of parts of life through a balanced psycho-spiritual lens. But essentially, it's about a framework for navigating the unknown. And that comes out in a couple of weeks.
That's wonderful. I have to say that when you talk about navigating the unknown, you're on the perfect show for that because in Cool Science Radio, we explore a lot of the unknown. And I cannot tell you how excited I am for you, for your quantum entanglement and love that came into your life, and for your new book and your new baby. That's awesome.
Yes.
So, Lee Melcher, thank you so much for joining us today on Cool Science Radio. It's been an absolute pleasure learning more about you and your journey.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. You can find this episode, as well as past episodes, on the KPCW website or on the new KPCW app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.
If you have a suggestion for a guest or topic for a future episode, email us at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.